Welcome to the first episode of the second season of the RJOS podcast. I'm your host, Liana Tedesco. This season, we will be highlighting the winners of the He for She, the She for She, and the Courage Awards. It has been such an honor to connect with our guests, learn about who they are, how they became to be our esteemed award winners, and what the Ruth Jackson Orthopedic Society means to them. We also discuss the future and how we, as listeners, can create a better and more equitable future for those interested in orthopedic surgery. My first guest, Dr. William Levine, is the chair of orthopedic surgery at New York Presbyterian Columbia University Medical Center. This is a true honor for me, as Dr. Levine has not only been a champion of women in orthopedics, but an incredibly important mentor of mine during my residency training. Let's get to it. Dr. Levine, welcome to the podcast.
Good evening. So great to see you.
So if you can tell our listeners a little bit about yourself, those who might not know anything about you.
Well, I always like to start in the beginning because I was born in Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada. So we give our shout out to Canada. And my parents decided that they wanted to, my dad really wanted to practice medicine in the States. They were both Canadian. And so they moved 4 hours due south of Winnipeg and stopped in Fargo, North Dakota, which is where they called home and where I went to public school all the way through till I was 18. And then I also like to say that I used my geographic diversity card to get into Stanford because they needed to check a North Dakota box. And so that led me to California. And it really, that's where I kind of convinced myself that I was going to become an orthopedic surgeon. During my first and second year summer, I stayed out there and spent the summer shadowing one of the team physicians for Stanford. And I thought, boy, if I could ever be a team physician and be an orthopedic surgeon, that would really be something that I would strive to do. I went from Stanford to Case Western Medical School, where I was really intrigued by the way they taught medical school. It was quite unique at the time. It was a systems-based approach, which of course everybody does now, but back in those days, they were the first, they were the pioneers. And it was also at Case Western where I also always give credit to Peter Scholes. Dr. Scholes was one of my, probably the mentor of all mentors. And I learned about mentorship from Peter. And his point of view was that if you were a Case student and you wanted to go into orthopedics, even though he wasn't officially, I don't think he had any role in the department in mentorship. He wasn't part of the residency leadership team. He was a pediatric orthopedic surgeon. And if you wanted to go into orthopedics, he would take you under his wing. And he basically said, you know, you do your job and I'll do my job. And it was really impactful. And I always thought, as I've said many times, Liana, that if I could pay that forward, that's what I would do. And obviously I've spent the last 3 decades of my career giving, paying homage to Dr. Peter Scholes. So thanks, Dr. Scholes. And from there, I did residency in Boston. I did my general surgery internship at Beth Israel and my orthopedics at Tufts. And of course, that's really where mentorship became critical, and some of my most influential mentors and then people who've evolved to become dear friends really influenced my future life. From there, I came to Columbia in 1995 to do a shoulder fellowship at the renowned Columbia Shoulder Program with Dr. Louis Biliani and Dr. Evan Flato, Dr. Roger Pollock at the time. And, you know, you never know where life will take you. And life took me from there to San Diego. I got an incredible job in a private practice group of all things. And they had an affiliation with UC San Diego. And it was one of those jobs like the firm. They never advertised, like only people died. And then they would find a person. And that was really, it was a connection through my mentor, Tom Thornhill at the Brigham, that a job opened up there. And so I went there for a variety of reasons, needed to actually leave that first job. And I became one of the statistics that we talk about all the time, Liana, which is 50% of people leave their job within their first job within 2 years and 75% within 5. And from there, I went to Baltimore, the University of Maryland, where I did a second fellowship in sports medicine with T. Mormon and Leanne Curl. It gave me an incredible opportunity to teach the Maryland residents. They had a necropsy suite. And so basically, because I was kind of there and just diving in, I would do, we would do arthroscopy labs like every week. They had unlimited cadavers. And so that was really awesome. And I had access and first time ever taking care of a professional team with the Baltimore Ravens and also Team Mormon because of the shock trauma experience. We did all these incredible multi-ligament knee injuries. So that was really something that added to my kind of area of expertise that I hadn't really done up to that point. At that same time, Dr. Biliani, my mentor at Columbia, had become the ninth chair of orthopedics at the New York Orthopedic Hospital, Columbia Orthopedics, and that was 1996-97. And then I did my fellowship in Baltimore, and then Dr. Biliani was looking to hire somebody to kind of merge the shoulder service and sports medicine, which really didn't exist. So I was 33. I had this incredible opportunity to come back to Columbia in 1998. And I looked all over the country at different jobs. And I thought, wow, how often do you get a chance to go to such a storied institution, but not have to be the 10th person in line on a really busy service and do something unique, do something kind of crazy and in my own vision. So I took that chance and came to Columbia in 1998. And as you know, I never left.
You have such a great story, and I think you've had so many unique experiences. So anyone who's listening would be smart to listen up. Can you talk a little bit about your time at Columbia as the residency program director? And obviously that was always important to you because of your mentorship experience, but how was that for you, and what did you learn from that?
So very early on, Laura Farese was the program director for Dr. Hal Dick, who was the eighth chair of the program. And Dr. Farese was a pediatric orthopedic surgeon who, for the listeners, later went on to incredible heights in hospital leadership and actually became number two in the New York Presbyterian system. She just retired last year after an incredible career. But Laura was the program director. And, you know, I saw very early on that Laura clearly had her eye on bigger fish, if you will. And, you know, being a program director is a tough job. And I think the residents, you know, felt like they wanted somebody maybe a little closer to their plight, if you will. And so it was just I had this opportunity to get involved. And so I became an assistant program director very early on, like really early. And then from there, I became the program director, like, I don't know. I mean, it was really, I think, 2 or 3 years after I started back at Columbia. So that was really quite an opportunity for me. And I did it because of my passion for the residency and for the residents. And I wanted to try to, you know, the thing that you have to understand is that Columbia had this incredible history and very rich. But unfortunately, part of the history that I saw when Pat Connor and I were co-fellows at Columbia in 1995 as shoulder fellows was the program had really fallen on hard times. The residents were not getting a great surgical experience. There was tremendous amount of hierarchy in the program. Fracture conference was often like, you know, you'd have to have a like bulletproof vest on because of the shrapnel that you would receive. And it was often like one faculty member using the resident to shoot at another faculty member. And the resident was just kind of being used as body armor. And I had never experienced anything like this. And so, you know, one of the reasons I wanted to be program director is I wanted to try to figure out a way to change culture. And that is a very hard thing to do because I was really an outsider. I did a year as a fellow, but I was not a Columbia through and through guy. And that's what the faculty looked like. The faculty in those days, Liana, was like, they were born at Columbia. They trained at Columbia. They, you know, everything was Columbia. And so to change a culture from outside in was kind of one of my first magic tricks that I had to learn. And I spent a long time chipping away at that. And slowly but surely, you know, you get other advocates, you know, some other faculty from outside and then from some from inside. And you start to chip away at some of the things where, you know, residents would do things to other residents a little bit like, you know, battered wife syndrome or battered spouse syndrome, where the abused becomes the abuser. And we saw that quite a bit. So we really worked hard to change that. And that was something I was really proud of because, you know, like I said, I think it was such a great storied program, but we needed to make some serious changes in how surgical education was done.
Obviously, the residency that I participated in was very different because of this culture change that you were able to, you know, as you say, magic trick perform. But what do you think the biggest challenge is for people who are trying to change culture? Maybe they go into a new environment and they see something they don't like, but they know that there's a better way. How can they, you know, execute that?
Well, I think you have to, you can't come in like a bull in a china shop, that's for sure. And especially if it's a proud place that, you know, even if that culture might have some things that as an outsider, you might say, boy, I think we could do this better. We could do it differently. So sometimes it's trying to infiltrate or insinuate yourself into whatever that culture is in a positive way, and then start to just role model some things that might be different. You know, so one of the things that's really interesting is to, you know, it's, as you know, when you're in a group, is how can you get the group to actually take your idea and then they think it's their idea because then they buy in and you can just sit back and say, yeah, that was awesome because now, you know, that's exactly what you were hoping to achieve. And then the group thinks that and feels like it was their idea. And there's a lot more buy-in that way. So I think part of that is, you know, whenever I interview anybody for a new job at Columbia in any capacity, whether it's a new faculty or a staff member, a fellow resident med student, whoever it might be, I always ask them, what is your strategy when you come into this new organization? And the answer that I'm usually looking for is to kind of go on the official listening tour, right? Don't come in and tell everybody what you're going to do differently. Certainly don't come in and say, oh my God, the last leader sucked and they were horrible and I'm going to come in and you know, be the knight in shining armor. That's a surefire way to fail. It will certainly start you out behind the eight ball. So I think, you know, listening and seeing what's going on, getting a sense of who the people are, just like I did when I was when I became the team physician at Columbia at age 33, you talk about 4 million eyeballs watching me, to just waiting for me to fail, because they weren't looking for a new team physician. That was thrust upon them by Dr. Biliani recruiting me. And so what did I do? I rolled my sleeves up and I said, you know what, this is how things were done before and this is how I'm going to be doing them now, but I'm all ears. You tell me if there's something that you think we should be doing differently or better. I leaned in so heavily to Jim Gossett and his unbelievable experience as the head athletic trainer. Obviously, as a team physician, a lot of analogies to what we do in medicine. But, you know, if you don't have the head athletic trainer as your ally, you are toast.
Yeah.
So I think there's a lot of good learning points there in how to manage and work with people in your new capacity. If you're a young faculty member and you get a job as an associate program director, you know, learn, listen. And then when you have ideas, you know, I love to see Bonnie Chen now in her new role as an associate program director at Columbia, because she's not had anything to do with the Columbia system in any facet of her training. So every idea she has is going to be, well, have you thought about this? Or maybe we could do this. And I think that's refreshing to have an outside look, even to a place where you think, oh, well, we've got a lot of this stuff figured out. There's a lot of things that we can always do better. And I think that's the mark for anybody listening. When you're in a program, a department, and they feel like they've got everything down pat and they don't need to do anything to get better, that's probably a pretty big red flag, because none of us have it down. And I hope we're always striving to get better. And that's certainly what we've tried to do at Columbia for these last 26 years.
That's great. We talked a little bit about your medical school mentor, but when you think back, I find that people have mentors at various stages of their career or their path. Can you talk a little bit about some of your non-orthopedic mentors?
My non-orthopedic mentors. I have had some really incredible non-orthopedic mentors, and a lot of them have been in this last or my most recent phase of life. As a leader and a department chair, because it's given me the opportunity to meet people outside of medicine that are, you know, influential leaders in business and in other areas. And that's given me a incredible insight in how to lead people, how to manage conflict, how to deal with adversity. And, you know, I'd say it a lot, but one of the things that's really important to understand for future leaders is that leadership is lonely. Leadership can be really hard at times. There's, you know, so having people either inside medicine or outside medicine that you can consider a mentor or somebody that you can call on and just say, boy, you know, I had a hard day. And they can relate because they've run Fortune 100 companies, they've run small businesses, they've maybe they're in entertainment. You know, it's really interesting to see. At the end of the day, humans, you know, whether you're running a hospital or running a department or you play in a rock and roll band, we all have these interactions, human interactions that, you know, can be good, they can be bad, they can be, you know, in the middle. And I think they're all relatable. I mean, just today I saw, you know, a patient who's a CEO of a major organization, another person who is a, you know, recreational athlete and was dealing with issues, and someone who's a stay-at-home parent. And each one of them, as you get older in your career and you spend more time talking to people and less time worrying about work RVUs and surgeries, it becomes more interesting. And you kind of get the sense of humanity about what's going on and how we're all kind of dealing with the same stuff.
I think that's so important to remember that obviously the technical side of what we do is so important, but there's also a big human component. And if you forget about that, it's really easy to get lost in our purpose.
Yeah, I saw a patient last Thursday, and I'll tell you a story because I think it's an important one for listeners to hear. 53-year-old patient who's had 7 prior shoulder surgeries. She's in my office, in the New Jersey office, Liana, and you know, she's got tons of red flags about stuff that are issues with her. She's disabled, she's this, she's that, and it would be so easy to just simply say, this patient, you know, has issues, there's psychological, emotional, spiritual issues, I don't know if we can help her, etc. And I spent probably an hour and 20 minutes with her. She was crying. She was devastated about how this has impacted her life and what and how you know, her pain, the pain that she has, the dysfunction she has, etc. And at the end of it, I don't know that I'm going to be able to help her surgically. I think I can, and I think we're going to do a combined plastic surgery, orthopedic surgery issue because she's got tremendous scar tissue and issues. But she was so grateful because I just spent time and talked to her and listened to her and probably did more validating of what's been going on for her than any surgeon ever has. And I'm not saying that to pat myself on the back at all. I'm just pointing out that it is easy to sometimes take the very quick path and the hard path, but the human path might be to actually spend more time, not less, even with the most difficult patients. And that gets to that whole concept we talk about leaning in to your complications and leaning in to a difficult patient, leaning in to a difficult relationship you might be having with a co-resident, leaning in to a difficult relationship you might be having with a faculty member, and really trying to make the best of it instead of hiding from it or, you know, getting defensive or even worse, festering resentment, which then leads to the typical blow up and kind of non-productive relationships that, you know what, at the end of the day, time's too short.
Yeah. Time's too short, but also we have more time than I think we want to give ourselves credit for. To your story, you know, you were able to spend time with this patient and now she probably feels a lot better about herself, about her situation. So it's a good lesson for everyone to learn. I want to switch gears a little bit to talk a little bit about Ruth Jackson. So when was the first time you learned about the Ruth Jackson Orthopedic Society? I feel like you've probably known about it since its inception.
I'm not that old. No, listen, I've known about Ruth Jackson for such a long time. And, you know, I have to acknowledge that, you know, if you think about my career trajectory and my influences, I didn't have a lot of female orthopedic surgeons in my life. Leanne Curl was one of my major influential mentors as a team physician for the Baltimore Ravens, now the first female NFL team physician, and has been so for many years. But I really didn't have a lot of contact with, at least at the attending level, at all. Tufts always had a pretty strong reputation and history of having female residents. But when I say that, that meant we had like, you know, maybe one a year, maybe one every other year. So it wasn't foreign, but it certainly wasn't like what we're used to now at Columbia. So, but what I did come from is a family with some very strong women. And so that's where my influence was of understanding the relationship between men and women, the relationship of women in the workforce. For the listeners that don't know my story, my mom got married at age 19, dropped out of college at the University of Manitoba, had five children by the time she was 32, and had picked up a college degree in various places at my dad's stops in his medical training, where he would ultimately become a urologist. So in 1972, at the age of 33, my mom said, okay, I want to do something now. I was seven. My little brother was four. The older brothers and sisters were in high school and kind of tucked away and doing their thing of the five kids. And so my mom literally sat down and wrote down on the back of a napkin what her interests were with my father. And the thing that came to the fore from doing that exercise was law school. And so growing up in Fargo, there is no law school in Fargo. The only law school is in Grand Forks at the University of North Dakota, which is 90 miles from Fargo. So my mom makes an appointment with the dean of the law school, of course, a white male at that time, not shockingly, and drives the 90 miles to Grand Forks, has the meeting with the dean, and says, listen, you know, this is my, tells him the story. And he looked at her with a straight face in 1972, like, this is what you said, and said, listen, I think you're a spoiled doctor's wife. You're not going to be motivated enough to do this. And this is crazy. And she was talking about coming back to law school and whatnot. But to his credit, well, first of all, my mom persisted. And to his credit, he accepted her. And so my mom drove back and forth 180 miles a day for 3 years. And graduated number one in her class. We hired a caretaker named Alice, like from the Brady Bunch. And my dad took over a lot of the the mom duties when he wasn't, you know, in the OR or practicing or whatnot. And so she graduates number one in her class. She becomes a lawyer and then ultimately becomes the first female and the first Jewish Supreme Court judge in the state of North Dakota's history. And then I have two sisters who are older, who are both, one's in finance and one's a physician. And then, of course, I have a wife who is a judge, and I have two beautiful, strong-willed, and independent, awesome daughters. So that is the world in which I have lived as far as my view of women. And Louis Biliani, likewise, had a very strong wife who was a general surgeon, two really strong, outstanding daughters. And so even though we didn't have a lot of faculty during Louis's tenure who were female, we did have a history and tradition of having a strong presence of females in the residency program. So when I think of now what I look at, I had an opportunity in my position in leadership to say, okay, well, now that I'm in this position, what can I do differently? And so learning about Ruth Jackson allowed me to say, okay, well, first of all, I want to get involved with Ruth Jackson. But mostly, I want to change the way our faculty looks. I want to see if our faculty can look the way society looks, the way medical schools look, and be a place where patients can come to and find somebody that not only is outstanding and the top of their class, but maybe looks like them, maybe can relate to them. And so RJOS became something that I probably learned about RJOS after I started to really think about what was most important from a departmental standpoint, from a organizational perspective. I didn't get involved as an organization with RJOS until recently, relatively speaking. But I think the principles of RJOS are something I espouse, not knowing as much about the organization as probably I should have.
I think that's probably true. I feel like for your mom and for all of the women who have worked with you, I think the sponsorship of those around us is so important, because without that encouragement and sponsorship, we can't take it to the next step. So can you talk a little bit about sponsorship and why that's important and why that's different from mentorship? Because I think some people maybe conflate the two ideas.
Yeah, I think that's a great question. So the three concepts or the three definitions are mentorship, sponsorship, and allyship. And allyship I love because it didn't even exist until I think it was added in 2021.
Probably.
To Webster's Dictionary. So mentorship is the classic relationship of mentor and mentee. It's the classic, I take you under my wings. You have your responsibilities. I have my responsibilities. The best mentor-mentee relationships are bi-directional, where the mentee does not come to that relationship and says, Liana, please mentor me. The best mentor-mentee relationship is where the mentee comes to Liana and says, you know, I've thought about X, Y, and Z. I've done this literature review. I'm thinking about career strategies. I know you did this. You went to your residency here. You did your fellowship there. You're in practice here. I think there's things that I'd like to bring to you in this relationship, and I'm hoping you can bring to me, and ultimately I can achieve my goals. That's like, whoa, blow me away, right? Somebody who's really coming prepared. And that relationship will evolve over time. Some of them will dissolve over time. Some of them won't work, and that's okay as well. You just want to acknowledge that. But the best mentor-mentee relationships are those that evolve, as I like to think of it, mentor-mentee, colleague-colleague, and then friend. That's really awesome. Sponsorship is like mentorship 2.0 or mentorship unplugged. Sponsorship is Liana's going to do the hand fellowship at NYU. And she wants to become a leader in ASSH. She wants to be a leader in that hand society, in the New York Hand Society, in the academy, and so forth. And so sponsorship is my connecting Liana with some of those opportunities. I can help open doors. I can help connect Liana, but Liana has to take that opportunity and crash through and blast through those doors and then take on that ownership of it. And then I fall into the background because it isn't about Bill Levine at all. It's about Liana Tedesco. And Liana has this leadership role in whichever organization. Yes, because I may have opened the doors, but beyond that, it's no longer me. Mm-hmm. Because if I, as the sponsor, if my person I'm sponsoring doesn't live up to their end of the bargain, doesn't work.
Right.
So just like my sponsors did the same for me, ultimately I had to go up to the podium and I had to moderate a symposium, and Louis wasn't there anymore. Evan wasn't there anymore, but they had given me those opportunities. Mm-hmm. And then allyship is, of course, this new concept where now we're going to try to, in our positions of power as a chair, as a director, as a whatever your role is, we're going to try to sponsor people who are underrepresented. So that might be women, that might be minorities in medicine, underrepresented minorities in medicine, or what have you. And so allyship is really that whole other avenue that we think about. And now it's controversial, and there's a lot of things we can talk about there because we're having challenges with allyship. And we're having challenges with sponsorship because of the Supreme Court decision and because of the backlash of diversity, equity, inclusion that we're now right smack in the middle of. And those will be challenges that we'll have to face together moving forward, because at the end of the day, this is about putting forth the best people, not the most diverse people, the best. And this will become, I'm sure we'll talk a little bit more about that as we continue this conversation.
Yeah, for sure. That was kind of going to go into my next question, is what are some of the arguments or this backlash in DEI that you're hearing? And like, what are people saying, and why is there so much pushback in your opinion? In your experience?
Well, we're in the midst of an incredibly challenging time. I mean, the world events right now are so disturbing and troubling to me as a Jewish person, and dealing with what we're dealing with right now and what the world's dealing with right now. The hatred that exists against anybody that looks different or is different is real. And so we just have to acknowledge that. So if you're a misogynist, if you're homophobic, if you're a racist, if you're an anti-Semite, if you're an anti-Muslim, if you're an anti-Palestinian, if you're anti-anything, then unfortunately, we've got challenges that go so far above kind of what we're typically thinking about. So you think about our country, and you think, I like to look at it like this. We elected the first Black president in Barack Obama, and people were celebrating how progressive we as a country were or are. I remember vividly when the LGBTQ+ colors of the rainbow were on the White House, and people were celebrating how progressive we are and how far we came. And what we found with the next election and with the next president is that there is a whole part of humanity and our society that did not feel comfortable with that, that did not like that, that did not think that being that quote unquote progressive was good, was the right thing to do. And this is not now me saying what's right or what's wrong or what's good or what's bad, but if you were doing a Chris Ahmad post-operative dissection of society, I think that's what happened. Mm-hmm. So Trump was unleashed onto our country because of the backlash of Obama liberal progressive politics. And so Donald Trump comes because of Barack Obama. This is, again, my one person's analysis, and people can agree to disagree if they don't like this. But I'm trying to not be political about it. I'm trying to just say what I think happened. Mm-hmm. And then you have a very, very significant push to the right at the Supreme Court level. As we know, again, that's not political, that's factual.
Yeah.
And then we have a Supreme Court that says affirmative action should be no more, in addition to women's rights and other significant personal issues. And so now, what was, you know, if you didn't have a diversity, equity, inclusion topic or committee or perspective, I mean, God forbid, right? 2 years ago, that would have been terrible. Well, today, let's be, again, factual, not political. At Columbia University, I cannot have a DEI scholarship for fourth-year medical students, which 3 years ago was lauded as a popular and appropriate and inclusive way to bring kids here who might not have the financial means. They had the academic means. They were not coming if they didn't have the academic chops. Let's be very clear. But they might not have had the financial means to come spend a month living in New York, paying for rent, et cetera, et cetera. So now we can't call it the DEI scholarship, and we just call it the Columbia Orthopedic Scholarships. David Roy was former chief of pediatric orthopedics at Columbia, started the David Roy / Pride scholarship for a fourth year visiting students for a member of the LGBTQ+ community to come and spend a month. That's fantastic, I think. Can't call it that now. So now we have to call it the David Roy Visiting Student Scholarship. So that's the state of where things are right now. The whole discussion has been turned topsy-turvy. As you know from being at Columbia for your career, the Perry Initiative, an incredible group that's allowed us to host amazing one-day workshops for young women who are either high school students or college students or medical students. And as you know, Kristen Russo has spearheaded that, current president of RJOS. And a white male decided that he would sue the Perry Initiative for being sexist because it was highlighting young women and not men. And Columbia University, again, like others, not just ours, but at least where I am, Columbia so far has forbade us from having a Perry Initiative until the dust settles. So I think about these things, and you know, it's sad to me because, again, we're never trying to exclude any particular group. But we have found it to be better for our society, better for our patients, better for our students, our residents, our fellows, to have a faculty, to have residents, to have fellows that do bring different perspectives. And being a woman in orthopedics, you have a different perspective than being a man. Being an underrepresented minority in orthopedics, you bring a wholly different perspective than being the majority white male. There's just no two ways about that.
Right. I think it just seems like there's such a big defense from everyone because of all the changes in our political environment. And so I think we as a community don't want this to get lost. What do you think we can do to prevent it from getting lost without maybe not being so overt about it, because that seems to be challenging to some of our bigger institutions?
Well, I think if you are committed to these issues, whether you put a title on it, whether you put a name on it, whether you put anything on it, I think that you will be committed to these issues, number one. Number two, and this is where I think we do need to be thoughtful about this and be honest about this. And as you very well know, when I am recruiting somebody who is female, who is gay, who is an underrepresented minority, I have the same conversation every single time. And they probably are getting bored of me talking about it. But basically, it goes like this. You have an opportunity. And I don't call it a burden, and I don't call it a responsibility. I say, you have an opportunity. I'm recruiting you to join this family, to join this team. And what I'm asking of you is to roll your sleeves up, put in the work necessary, like I did and like so many did before you, and earn people's respect, trust, and appreciation for being an outstanding orthopedic surgeon. Don't talk about being a female orthopedic surgeon. Don't talk about being a gay orthopedic surgeon. Don't talk about being a Black orthopedic surgeon. Just talk about being an outstanding orthopedic surgeon. Now, for people who are racist or who misogynist or who are homophobic, they're going to think you're there because of that reason no matter what. Those are not the people that we are trying to change their minds. But for everybody else who at some point or another has said, oh, I know why she's here. I know why he's here. I know why that person is here. Those are the people that need to be influenced in a positive way and just demonstrate what you that you are here because you were the best person in the country, and that's why I recruited you. And so that's the opportunity that I try to present to people who aren't part of the majority until the numbers shift. When the numbers shift, you can kind of think of that a little bit differently. But for right now, I think we're still in that point. And I love Josie Curry's, you know, line in our RJOS video to celebrate the anniversary, where she said, you know, at Columbia, I've never been called a female orthopedic surgeon. I don't think of myself as a female orthopedic surgeon. I'm an orthopedic surgeon. And I think that sums it up. That to me is, if you can create that, then I think you've really achieved what we want, which is to that nobody will ever say, Liana Tedesco was put high on our match list because we had to have a female.
Right.
Liana Tedesco was put high on our match list because she was a stud. That's why.
Right. Yeah, I think this idea that there's an opportunity for everyone and you just have to pull yourself up by your bootstraps and do the best job you can because of who you are and your qualifications is so important. And without the sponsorship of people like yourself, Dr. Levine, like we're going to lag behind other specialties, other, you know, industries. And I think we just have to make this something that's known and give everyone else the opportunity to do the same. So all of our guests are winners of either the He for She, the She for She, or the Courage Award, and you won the He for She Award, which was no surprise to me as I was part of your nomination committee. But I would love to know from your perspective what it meant to have won this award. I mean, you've talked a lot about all of the females that you have around you and your family at work. What did it mean to win that award?
Well, you know, I think for all of us, I'll speak for myself for sure. You don't do things to win awards and you don't do things for outside recognition. I think, you know, from my standpoint, I sat down with Steve Corwin, the CEO of New York Presbyterian, and I told him what my 5-year vision was for the department. And I said that there were 3 things that were really important to me. Number one, we needed to do something completely outside the box in spine surgery because what was happening for the last 20 something years wasn't working. And so we came up with this crazy idea and oh my God, it actually worked. So that was quite remarkable. Number two was we had to do something remarkably different in tumor surgery. And I needed to recruit somebody to really change the face of tumor surgery at New York Presbyterian. And that became Wakenda Tyler. And wow, what an incredible recruitment that was. And number 3 was diversity. And I put it, you know, maybe today I would get, you know, in trouble for that. But that was really important. I looked at our department and it was, you know, 99% white males. And I thought we needed to make a change. So 14 females later, 4 underrepresented minorities in medicine later, we have made a change. And I think about that as really important for the legacy of Columbia and for New York Orthopedic Hospital, not for Bill Levine, And everything I try to do is always, as you know, to promote the department and promote the people here, not for me. So I thought it was important to make sure that we elevated women in our department and to get faculty. And, you know, we're at 40% female residents right now, which I think is fantastic. And, you know, 14 female faculty, I think is also outstanding. But again, as we've said, it's not just about hiring women. It's about hiring these amazing leaders, mentors, role models. And by the way, they might happen to have, you know, a couple of X chromosomes.
No, I think that's so important. And I mean, I know this very well, but the way you view the department and how it is a family is so integral to, I think, the success of that mission for, you know, obviously with spine and with tumor, but also with diversity and just making a department that looks like the patient population that we are trying to help and treat. It's been really impressive. And even in my short time, I saw it change quite a bit, which was great. So I want to thank you so much for joining me. I do have one final question for you, and I hope that it doesn't have to be one line, but I do like a little snippet. But what advice do you wish you had gotten when you were younger? Or what advice would you give your younger self?
Well, I think the advice that I would have given my younger self, and I thought about this along the way, but I never did it, is that I would definitely have gotten an MBA.
That's good advice. Practical.
If I knew that I was going to be in a leadership position as a department chair, especially as this job has evolved and morphed over the last, you know, 9 years that I've been doing it, but certainly over the last probably 15 to 20 years, you know, these have become real businesses. In the old days, chairs didn't have to be CEOs or CFOs. They kind of, you know, you ran the academic mission and the finances kind of took care of themselves because everybody was making a buttload of money. There was slush funds. You didn't worry about dean's taxes. You didn't worry about how do you fund research. You had all this extra money around. And boy, times have changed. So that would be my one piece of advice.
I think that's an excellent and practical piece of advice for anyone interested in leadership because, as we've talked about many times, there are a lot of things they don't teach you in medical school that you need to know when you want to be a physician or if you want to be a physician. Even if you don't want to be a leader, you don't want to be a chair, if you are just working private practice, if you don't know anything about the business side of medicine, you might be starting off at a bit of a disadvantage. Maybe in 20 years or 10 years, business will be part of the medical school education because it would be beneficial for everyone.
Agreed.
Dr. Levine, thank you so much for joining me. This was such a great conversation and there's so much to learn from your experiences. And I can't thank you enough.
Thanks, Liana. Appreciate it.